everybody. Welcome to another episode of F This Movie. It is that time of year again. It is Scary Movie Month on F This Movie, and that can only mean one thing, that JB and I have just locked ourselves in a theater for 24 hours and sat through 13 consecutive horror films as part of the Music Box Massacre 2011.
And if you're marveling to the amount of excitement that Patrick can pump out at will, here's an experiment you can try. Call up one of the other podcasts and compare his voice, because just now as you were talking, I said, that sounds slower and deeper than he sounds on any other podcast. And I'm crabby because I haven't had my nap.
Listen, you know, we've been up for close to 36 hours. I don't even know if that's accurate.
You
that's
have.
Probably. Oh, yeah. You got a little bit of sleep. I've been up for about 36 hours because we do the Music Box Massacre. We go see all the movies and then we come home and we say right away we have to record a podcast. I guess so it sounds like this. This is the appeal, that I sound slower and deeper and sadder.
Perhaps we must rethink our strategies.
A little more defeated. We're going to be talking about the Music Box Massacre, which happens every year in Chicago, thanks to Rusty Nails.
And we love Rusty.
We love Rusty. We love the Music Box Massacre, the Movie Side Film Festival, the Music Box Theater in Chicago.
The happiest place on earth.
That was your cue.
This shows how tired we are. I'm late with the happiest place on earth cue. And I'm so glad they hosted it. It really had a much nicer atmosphere this year.
Definitely. And we're going to be talking about 13 different movies. But of course, before we do that, I have to go through all our nonsense, like the fact that you can find our website at fthismovie.blogspot.com.
Nonsense.
Facebook.com/fthismovie.
Nonsense.
Twitter.com/fthismovie.
More nonsense.
DVDverdictpresents.com.
Not nonsense.
Not nonsense
DVD
at all.
DVD Verdict. We love DVD Verdict. And again, my man crush on Michael Staley goes unabated.
And you can find us in the iTunes store as well if you just go in there and search F This Movie. And you can leave us a nice review if you want. Don't leave a mean one. We're tired and we can't deal with it. Right now it's Scary Movie Month and we're still running the F This Movie, F Scary Movies Challenge 2. Our goal was to get to, I think, 150.
Pshaw.
We're closing in on 200. We're killing it. So go to fthismovie.blogspot.com anytime you watch a horror movie in the month of October and write a 7-word review.
7 words. No more, no less.
Yeah. So we're going to read some of our favorites again. And if there are repeats, not from previous shows, but from the same people, it's only because a lot of the same people are really participating a lot and writing some great stuff. So if we read more than one from a specific person, that's why.
Which we appreciate. The original goal was to get 150. That has been revised. We're now going for 17,000. 17,000 by Halloween. Jan Batig writes, Dreamhouse. Spoiler alert. This movie isn't very good.
Eric, who is on the show, but I'm still going to read one of his. I know that we don't really read our own, but Eric wrote a really funny one for Child's Play. Child's Play, to do tonight, burn my daughter's dolls.
Very good. Very good advice. And I'm scrolling, and I'm scrolling, and I'm scrolling. Cameron, Claudier, who posts on the site very often, has posted a 7-word review of Creepshow 2, which I still remember from the first and only time I've ever seen it. He writes, beware of wooden Indians, oil, and hitchhikers.
Ross Reeder, who's been playing a lot, says of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre remake, revolting, uninspiring, hopeless mess, plus Jessica Biel.
I know you hate this, but yes. I have to quote one Patrick Bromley.
No, don't quote me.
With the cool Phantom of the Paradise icon thingy, avatar. Targets! Hey, stop shooting at Boris Karloff, asshole!
Thank you. Luke says of Duel, one man, one shitty car, psychotic truck.
Heath Holland, who is becoming one of our favorite listeners, has posted many reviews in the last couple days, and one of them is of the Spanish version of Dracula, which you all know was filmed concurrently with the one we're more familiar with.
Starring Carlos
Villarias.
Villarias.
Who, Heath gets to that point.
Oh.
His review, darker, sexier, perhaps better, but needs Lugosi. If you could somehow use Photoshop or iMovie or Final Cut Pro to take the Spanish version
right.
and cut Lugosi into it.
Somebody's going to do it, too.
I
got to give Heath Holland props, too, for his reversal of one that I wrote about Frank Langella, and Heath reversed it and said, like, Bela Lugosi, you are no Frank Langella. And it's fun when people are messing with the entries that are already in there.
And Adam actually went to the remake of The Thing on Friday and posts, could have been worse, but still not good. And Patrick and I finally got to meet Adam
yes.
at The Massacre.
Adam Risky, who posts a lot on our Facebook page and always has great comments. And we've spoken via email, fthismovie.blogspot.com, and had a lot of great conversations. And he was at The Music Box Massacre, and it was really, really cool to meet him.
And it was great to meet him, and he wasn't a psycho.
Not at all.
He seemed...
I think we were the crazy one.
Well,
you see how I made us one person?
He started talking to Patrick sort of about film, which I have no interest in.
Right.
And so I was just softly licking the inside of Adam's ear, and he really seemed to dig it.
He had some good ones Massacre.
Adam attended the entire Massacre.
Yeah.
And some of these are great. For the first film of The Massacre, Waxworks, Adam wrote, "Wake me up when this is over."
Aish. Another good one from The Massacre that Adam wrote... Give me a second. Vampire Lovers. Ingrid Pitt / Madeline Smith. What a pair.
Which you get if you've seen the film.
Yeah.
And finally, Adam wrote of Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things, which we're going to discuss pretty extensively in a few minutes. His 7-word review, children and adults shouldn't watch this movie.
So that's a good segue into talking about The Music Box Massacre. This was the 7th. Music Box Massacre, held at the Music Box Theater in Chicago by Rusty Nails, who does an incredible job every year of programming
Great
an interesting
job.
Festival. It's always really varied. Things are organized. Things were all on time this year.
Yeah.
It really moved along nicely. I had a good guest. So we're going to be talking about that. You've been to all of the Music Box Massacres. I didn't go to the first one. I was in grad school.
I have been to all of them.
Yeah. So I've only been to 6, and last year was the first time I went for the full 24 hours because of this podcast.
Which I thought you learned from.
I thought I did, too.
And would apply that lesson to this year.
Because after last year, I was like, I don't think I'll do that again. And then as this one got closer, I started to think, no, I should for the podcast.
It's an obsessive compulsive dream.
It is, but I can't imagine I'll do it again. I say this now, October 16th, 2011. Let's see what happens in 2012. But
I've never had a baby. I've helped... with a baby.
Sure.
But I've never had a baby.
Yes.
People have said it looks like I'm about to have a baby. But I've never had a baby, but I've always read that the pain of childbirth fades very quickly, or no woman would ever have a second child. Such do I think about The Massacre.
I think you're right.
As the months go by, you start to really look forward to it, and I get there crazy early, because I like to be first in line, because I have issues. Daddy, if I'm first in line, will you? Anyway, so it was a pretty long wait, but the minute we get in the theater and we get these seats in this row that we like, that all vanishes and I'm the happiest millionaire.
It was a lot of fun. Things kicked off with a silent film called Waxworks with live organ accompaniment by Dennis Scott. I think that's the way that all of the massacres have started, with a silent film with live organ accompaniment. And obviously we're starting to run out of maybe silent horror films.
I think maybe he wants to plumb the Lon Chaney catalog a little further, because most people...
London After Midnight.
Okay. Mr. Esoteric.
That's not esoteric.
It's a lost film. If you could find a print of it,
show it at The Massacre.
It would be like winning the lottery at this point.
Or, but, you know what, just show stills and then splice in footage from Curly Sue, and no one will know. No
TCM
one will know.
Once recreated it using the script, the score, and stills. And the one thing that every horror fan still alive found out is it's not the greatest movie.
Yeah.
Everyone was expecting it to be, you know, Dracula, Frankenstein caliber.
Right.
It's about an insurance investigator.
Dracula meets Frankenstein caliber?
No, we'll talk about that soon. It's a Dracula meets the insurance investigator caliber, because it's about an insurance investigator who pretends to be a vampire to catch a criminal. Because you have to remember, back in the silent days, this is why Dracula so broke the mold. It had to be based on a literary classic,
right,
or it had to be a dream or someone dressing up.
Right.
There had to be a rational explanation. Dracula is the first one American film that says, oh no,
there's monsters.
He's a monster.
Right, right, right.
He's real.
Right.
Waxworks, on the other hand.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to start by saying, like, The Massacre overall was different this year. I think Rusty, because it's the seventh one, maybe because he's played a lot of sort of well-known classic horror films, this year he went more experimental, more esoteric.
More obscure.
Yeah, much more obscure, to the point where I had maybe seen half of the movies. It might have been a full half that I had not seen.
There were two that I had never seen, and I had never seen some of them in a movie theater before,
right,
which is always great, because one of the things I like about Massacre was that was the first time I ever saw Bride of Frankenstein in a real movie theater.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was the first time I'd ever seen Abbott and Costello meet Frankenstein in a real movie theater, because it's the video age. Waxworks is odd, though, because you got your Nosferatu.
Yes.
Classic, deservedly so. You have your Caligari.
Yes.
Classic, deservedly so. And then I think on most people's lists, you have Phantom of the Opera and Hunchback of Notre Dame, and then you're done.
Jekyll and Hyde.
The John Barrymore version gets played a lot.
Which he showed a couple of years ago, which was pretty cool.
And sometimes in a pinch, people play The Unholy Three, but The Unholy Three isn't a horror film.
Either is Waxworks.
No, not really.
But it is often considered. Well, I have this box from, I think, Kino, this box set.
American?
Right.
Oh, no, it's
Nosferatu, Caligari, The Golem, and Waxworks.
And a documentary about,
right,
about German horror, I think.
I believe so.
And Waxworks is a catch-all. We go to a wax museum, and the figures inspire three little short stories.
So it's kind of like the first horror anthology movie.
Very much. And if you're into the famous actors of German Expressionist cinema, it's got Conrad Veidt from Cabinet of Dr. Caligari in Casablanca. It's got Werner Cross from Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. It's got Emil Jannings. It's got, like, all these stars in what looks to be, like, 2 days' work apiece.
Kind of, yeah.
And the comment that I made, and again, folks, it's been a rough 24 hours. When it was playing, and I think you're going to hear this coming up again and again in the podcast, it has the strange painted sets of Caligari, but it doesn't work as well.
Right.
It has the strange mannered acting of Caligari, but it doesn't work as well. It comes across as really self-aware. It comes across as really pretentious. And visually, I thought a lot of it looked like a children's book.
Yeah, do you think some of that was... do you think any of that was deliberate at all because of sort of the whole storytelling conceit versus Caligari, which is sort of a dream conceit that they're... That, but they're going for that?
But clearly there were times, and especially in the Ivan the Terrible story and the all-too-brief Jack the Ripper story, where it did look too much like a storybook, and it made me give much more credit to Caligari, which presents it as being uncanny.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's not real, but those are real people walking through it.
Right.
And it's not quite a painting or a viney bush. It's, where are we?
And you don't get that feeling of, like, these people are putting on a show for me, which is what Waxworks felt like the time. And again, and this is something I'll probably keep saying on the podcast, maybe because this year's lineup was more esoteric, but even when I didn't necessarily like something, and there were a number of films this year that I didn't really like, I was very happy to have seen it, especially in a theater, especially in this setting. And one of the things I like so much about The Massacre is that it kind of has something for everyone, because, you know, horror is just this big blanket genre, and there's so many different kinds of horror movies within it. And Rusty's always real good about picking a little bit from each, I think.
Yes, which I give him a lot of credit for. If you love Vincent Price, we had Abominable Dr. Fives.
Right.
If you were obsessed with horror concerning your genitals, there was that short film that they showed at 2 or 3 in the morning.
What I was going to say about Waxworks was I wasn't loving it, but I was happy to be seeing it. And then we get to the Jack the Ripper story, which is third, and my heart kind of sinks because I'm like, oh no, there's a whole story to go still. And then it's over in 3 minutes and credits and we're done.
And I had the opposite reaction because okay. I thought it was leading up to the Jack the Ripper. The Jack the Ripper would be the scariest
okay.
and the longest.
Yeah.
And I wasn't the only one who was very surprised by the brevity of that segment.
Because there's like a little special effect and you're like, oh, maybe this is why it's sort of a horror film or whatever. And then it's over. I had a dream about Jack the Ripper. The end.
And it literally says the end on the screen. And I can't repeat what Patrick just said loudly enough. If you like films, you should want to see all kinds of films. And if you love horror films, which I'm assuming everyone listening to this does in October, you should want to see all kinds of horror films.
Right.
And we love the fact that Rusty gives us that chance. Second up was Burn Witch Burn, which was interesting because
otherwise known as Night of the Eagle.
And obviously, if you've seen the film, you know why that was one of the alternate titles.
Over and over again.
A funny thing happened, and I love when this happens. Years and years ago, before Penn and Teller moved to Las Vegas, they used to live in New York, and they used to have a movie club. A bunch of friends that would all go to movies together.
I think you've told this story on the podcast before.
And there were rules.
I think on the Music Box Massacre podcast.
When someone in the film says the title of the film out loud as
a line
of dialogue.
Which happens a lot in movies.
And you could almost see the American distributor of Burn Witch Burn watching it and thinking, Night of the Eagle? Really? In America, that would almost sound like a patriotic film about the Civil War or something.
Right.
And when we get to the point where the one character says, Burn Witch Burn, the entire audience sort of...
Right. And Burn Witch Burn, of course, makes it sound slightly more lascivious or exciting than it actually is because it's kind of a stuffy British movie. But one that it was sort of one of the more happy surprises of the massacre.
Beautiful print.
And the photography in the movie is great. The print was great. And it, you know, you had said after the movie ended that it, at least for the first half, does introduce a lot of ideas.
That we start the film and we have a college professor who writes about the psychological foundations of superstition.
The first line of the movie is him saying, I do not believe.
And
writing it on the chalkboard.
Wow. For a horror film to talk about belief versus science, superstition versus logical reality, I'm giving this film mad credit. But as it went on, it began to resemble a Twilight Zone episode.
Right.
That sort of wore out its welcome, that didn't know where to go, that sort of seemed padded out.
By the end.
There were some special effects at the end that were unfortunate in that you really applaud the idea, but the way it was executed came across oddly.
Right.
And I wonder if not showing the feathered monster in the hallway at all...
Crazy Chicken World.
...would have been more effective and actually would have contributed to their point.
Right.
They show you the monster
and
then later on suggest it was in his mind.
Right.
Well, if it was...
We shouldn't have seen.
Don't show it. But there's people in the audience saying, I want to see an enormous bird chasing a man down a hallway.
There's one shot where it's at once ridiculous, but also you it does catch you off guard. You're like, oh my God, that's a huge bird. And it's really fast. And it's kind of neat for a second. But
because
it's
the hallway's a miniature.
Right, I know.
And because it's too narrow for the bird to flap its
wings.
I didn't
think they got a huge bird. Where do they find that bird?
Steroids.
And why doesn't he get more work?
Steroids. They built this miniature hallway and the bird can't flap its wings. So at one point, it's sort of hopping because they're doing something.
Yeah.
I can imagine them poking it from behind.
The middle section actually reminded me of a movie that he showed last year, George Romero's Season of the Witch.
Yes.
Which was also called Hungry Wives. So you have all this title changing, always dealing with witches and wives and sort of men's the way that we try and keep women in a certain place.
And that we have a big problem with powerful women.
Yeah. And this actually doesn't necessarily pertain to the massacre, but since this show is coming out immediately, I have to give a quick plug to a movie that is currently playing in very limited release. And if you're able to see it, it's called The Woman. It's directed by Lucky McKee, who made May, one of the best horror movies of the last decade, I think. Had some things in common with Burn, Witch, Burn. And so while I was watching that, I was thinking of The Woman, which I had just seen the day before. Some similar themes at work. Go see The Woman if you're able to. Back to the massacre.
It's playing in our area, and I have been given the homework assignment of going to see it because Patrick wants to discuss
There's
it with
There's so someone. Many giant birds in it.
I just want to reiterate what we were saying about Burn, Witch, Burn. And part of it, of course, was the great print. It was super sharp. But there was a professionalism to the British film industry back then. The sets, the costumes, the cinematography, the performances that really made you feel like here is a professional organization that's looking to at least entertain me in some way, which was missing from some of the later films, only because I think two of the films in particular sort of came across like photographed high school stage plays. Right.
And again, horror is sort of the only genre where you get a lot of that because you don't necessarily need talent or resources to put a horror movie together. You just need one sort of exploitable element. One of those things we'll get to, I think, very soon.
And horror audiences are the most forgiving, the most gullible, the most needy, we have the most discretionary income, he said, looking around at all the gewgaws.
We are surrounded by hundreds of monsters in chronological order.
Including an action figure of Pumpkinhead, which we'll talk about in a little bit. The next film up for the Music Box Massacre was Hour of the Wolf.
Perhaps the most experimental and controversial choice of the massacre.
And our friend Paul, who was there and knows a lot about film, had been talking to me for days saying, I won't attempt an imitation of Paul's voice, but he said he was most interested to see how the audience would react. And I actually think the audience reaction to The Hour of the Wolf was interesting.
Okay.
The film is odd.
Yes.
As Patrick said, the minute it ended, it seemed like a parody at times of what Bergman became known for.
Right.
That all of the elements that make up his more successful films are here serving a story that's supposed to be surreal or fantasy versus reality or some sort of allegory, and I'm not quite sure if it works. A lot of his favorite cast members, it's practically the cast of Seventh Seal and the cast of Persona jammed together, little Wild Strawberries mixed in. And we get the interminable single actor monologue to the camera.
Over and over again.
That until I saw Hour of the Wolf, was that yesterday or?
That was yesterday, yeah.
Was that yesterday in reality or in the crazy chicken world? It never occurred to me that, you know, Woody Allen is clearly this huge Bergman fan.
Yeah.
And it never occurred to me until I watched Burn, Witch, Burn that Woody Allen's films feature a lot of characters talking right to the camera.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that's a melding of his stand-up tradition. Think of the beginning of Annie Hall where he directly addresses the camera.
Right.
And if some of it's from Bergman. But there's a lot of that. Halfway through, it becomes a David Lynch film.
Yeah, Max von Sydow goes on sort of this crazy trip. I don't mean like a drug trip. Like
he goes to this castle where...
You think he's murdered someone, and then he goes off to this castle where things get wacky. They're putting makeup on him, and people are walking on walls and ceilings.
And suddenly, it's really interesting for about 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, this could have been 90 minutes of this, which, I mean, at the time it was made, I'm sure what we have was pretty...
And I guess that's the section that sort of not justifies its inclusion, because obviously Rusty doesn't need to justify its inclusion, but there were certain movies where I kept wondering, like, okay, why? I wonder why he chose this. And when we got to that section in Hour of the Wolf, I thought, oh, here it is. Here's what we've been waiting for.
And the audience was very respectful.
Yeah.
And clapped a lot when it was over, and did not hoot or catcall during it, didn't shout out jokes. And I got the feeling, and maybe I'm way off, that the applause at the end was a lot of people saying, I saw a film by Ingmar Bergman.
Maybe. You know, the audience is always, for the most part, it's a lot of fun, and they're always clapping for their favorite cast members in the credits. They always clap for the titles and the directors, especially when somebody's in attendance.
In Halloween, they clap for their favorite kills.
I always have a lot of fun with that. But yeah, the Bergman reaction was interesting. But again, everybody was quiet and respectful, and I know a lot of people maybe weren't crazy about it, but it was a chance for a bunch of horror fans to sit together and watch a Bergman movie, you know?
It's true, and that led to Abominable Dr. Fibes, and I thought that was interesting counter-programming.
Things lightened up considerably at that point.
Because Fibes is just fun, although I still find it padded that what we have here is this really great 75-minute movie
right. That's
been fleshed out to 120 minutes with interminable musical numbers.
Yeah.
Somehow, it's not enough that he was a famous surgeon. He's also an organ virtuoso.
And why do you suppose they set it, like, in the time period that they set it in? Because the movie's made in the early 70s?
Yes, and it takes place in the 20s.
Right.
And every time I've seen it, and God knows I've seen it enough times, it's like the production designer was owed a favor, and he said, I'd really, really like to do the whole movie Art Deco, because the entire film,
right,
the sets are amazing, but it doesn't seem to have anything to do with...
And I forget, and that's why I ask, because whenever I see the movie, I forget that it's set in the 20s until some obvious mention is made, or they talk about when Fibes' wife was born or died or whatever.
Or the car, or the Victrola.
It's kind of jarring because, again, you have this whole sort of wacky opening in his lair, and that screams just sort of like 60s funky craziness.
And the other weird thing is, and I think this was specific to the 70s, because I know lately films and television shows have been doing a better job at this, but no matter what period a film made in the 70s takes place in, ostensibly, it screams this was made in the 70s.
Right.
Something about the time.
Yeah.
Because think of something like Boardwalk Empire. Boardwalk Empire really seems to try to get the haircuts right. For example. The haircuts seem to be
That's
problem
the giveaway.
With getting these things right.
Yeah, Fibes definitely goes on too long because there's a kill sort of maybe three quarters of the way through the movie, and I don't know if you know it's the one with the unicorn. I don't want to spoil it. It sort of reaches its logical conclusion that these kills have been very elaborate and always, you know, right before the police arrive, and it gets to a point where essentially Fibes just says, fuck it, and right in front of the cops, impales this doctor on like a bronze unicorn or brass unicorn. And it's hilarious. And there's this great sight gag where they're twisting it, trying to pull it out of him, and you see his feet turning around because he's twisting with it. It's great. And that, to me, is the point where, like, okay, now we move into Act 3 because we've hit the punchline of what you're doing. But there's several kill sequences after that, including one with rats in an airplane.
And what's odd about that
is the equivalent of the bees in Sleepaway Camp.
We don't even see the first one. It's only talked about.
Right.
The Plague of Boils, which apparently he accomplishes with bees. The budget included thousands of dollars for Art Deco furniture. Unfortunately, we couldn't afford a bee wrangler. Although later we get Locust. Maybe they just felt it would be too similar.
Perhaps. And last year, Rusty showed Theater of Blood, and we both commented when Dr. Fibes ended that it's essentially the same movie.
Yes.
And that we have the same problem with Theater of Blood. There's too many of these kill sequences that he needed to do it fewer times, and it would have worked better. But it's a totally fun movie.
And then we move on to my favorite uncle, Herschel. I have seen Herschel Gordon Lewis before, but only at fan conventions, not speaking in front of a large audience. And you must admit he was charming and avuncular.
He was delightful.
And like all the good massacre guests, has a sense of what he's done and what he's made. I'm thinking of the Chiodo brothers.
Right.
Who were tons of fun.
And just know to tell stories.
That's
be entertaining.
What we're here to hear. We're here to hear stories. And then on occasion you get other guests that don't seem to understand why they've been brought here.
Robert Hiltzik.
No name.
There was a little bit, Robert Hiltzik. There was a slight element, I thought, of like the Jay Leno show with the Herschel Gordon Lewis interview, and I'm not criticizing the interviewer. I don't know who it was, but it seemed like Herschel Gordon Lewis had some things that he wanted to accomplish, and so the questions were just sort of setups to that, like, hey, did you ever think about turning one of your shows into a musical? Which then Herschel Gordon Lewis launches into the story about how he's actually singing the theme song to 2000 Maniacs, and then leads the audience in a live performance of the theme song.
Which was fun.
Which was neat. Again, I haven't even seen 2000 Maniacs. I have no relationship to Herschel Gordon Lewis, but you knew that you were a part of something kind of unique.
Yes, an event. I do wish the interview had been longer. I wish they had talked to him more about his films. His partner in crime recently passed away. I was hoping for a question about him. But it was wonderful to see him. And then they showed The Wizard of Gore, which is not the film they usually show to accompany Herschel. I would think they would usually show one of the three Blood trilogy films, as it were.
Or even 2000 Maniacs.
Which is one of the three.
Oh, is it? Is that one of the three?
Color Me Blood Red,
okay.
2000 Maniacs, and Blood Feast.
Oh, I had no idea. I thought all the Blood trilogy had blood in the title.
No, and oddly enough, I don't think Wizard of Gore is considered part of the Blood trilogy, although thematically and stylistically it could, because he made that for another company, I think without Friedman, and he did that one later.
So let's talk about Herschel Gordon Lewis movies.
Yes.
This was the first one I'd ever seen.
You're kidding.
No. And he is obviously an icon in the world of horror. I understand sort of what he introduced into the genre, for better and for worse. I know that there are a lot of people that were very excited to see him that are huge fans of his movies. What is the deal?
I'm not the most politic or diplomatic person.
Okay. All right.
This is problematic.
Mm-hmm.
We have tremendous affection for what he did. Hey, why don't we make it really gross?
Right.
He was the first.
Right.
And we have tremendous love for him because he's a charming, wonderful man.
Yes.
The films are terrible.
Right.
By any measure. Although I think Herschel would own up to that and say, we had this much money on this long of a shooting schedule, and we played mostly in drive-ins, and we cleaned up.
Right.
So I don't think... I don't think I've ever heard of an interview where he was sort of confronted with the artistry of his films or maybe a claim by anyone that he's an auteur. But these aren't films in an accepted sense. I mean, they're very amateurish.
I don't even necessarily hold him responsible. And obviously, you know, his fans aren't on the podcast to defend themselves. But I don't understand the cult of fandom that has built up. To where, like, as a horror fan, and we'll get into this again in a few movies, but as a horror fan, there are certain filmmakers who just don't do it for me, and I feel like a leper at times. Like, how could you be a horror fan and not love Herschel Gordon Lewis? Because honestly, if gore is the thing, obviously he had a low budget and bad actors, and the special effects were very different at the time he was making the movies. But if the gore is the appeal, it's terrible.
The only thing I could think of, and
it's like watching a porn with horrible sex in it.
I think that's a good way to put it. In Herschel Gordon Lewis's films, to a certain type of horror movie lover, you have the perfect storm of risible content that's easy to make fun of because the acting is beyond amateurish. The dialogue is often unintentionally funny. We have everything that you would look for in something that sort of a hipster would want to mock. And then, like clockwork, every 10 minutes, you get something that's really very difficult to look at. And I think it's that delirious dichotomy between amateur high school production. Look at this gallbladder.
Right. I mean, it's certainly watching it, I was definitely thinking of like Lloyd Kaufman and Troma movies, which obviously have taken a great deal from Herschel Gordon Lewis. And those, I think, movies play a little bit more like comedy. I mean, I know Herschel Gordon Lewis is aware of what his films are. I know he's not necessarily setting out to make great art. The Wizard of Gore, in particular, was problematic because, while I had a good time watching it because in a big audience, again, I don't love to watch things ironically, but it became funny because it is so terrible, and I became very aware of the fact that there are just so many mistakes in the movie that are funny. And again, it's because of the budget. It's because they're working fast with maybe not a totally professional crew. So I get all that. But there's just so many instances where I would think, boy, you didn't want to do one more take of that, Herschel? And the big one is near the end when the lead actor is saying concentrate over and over again into the camera. And at one point says concentrate. And they didn't go back and do another take. It's like, no, it's fine. Just leave it. He says the word wrong.
And the entire audience laughed.
Oh, my gosh. I couldn't stop laughing because it was just, it had built and built and built all these mistakes. And I was like, are you got to be kidding me? Now they're saying words wrong.
And at that point, my mind had wandered.
Yeah.
And I missed it.
Yeah. And you're just wondering why everybody's laughing.
And it's like, oh, what, someone read their line wrong in a Herschel Gordon Lewis film?
I mean, actors are looking into the camera and just making mistakes. The structure of the movie is exhausting because it's just, it's the same thing over and over again that this magician gets up on stage and says, I'm going to show you a trick. And then it turns out to be this horribly gory thing. And then someone dies. And then they say, let's go back to his show tomorrow night. And they do this 6 times. And then the movie ends.
And the main character's boyfriend keeps getting dragged to these magic shows. And we start to really commiserate with the boyfriend. Really? We got to go back for a 3rd night?
I just even love the conceit that this woman who hosts her daytime talk show for ladies.
Coffee time with the...
For the wives. Or I don't know.
Coffee time with
her
wives.
Big goal is to get this magician on her show who does these horribly gory tricks, like
always with women, is the
right victim. here, ladies, you won't believe what you're seeing. But I will say something about the gore, which is ridiculous. And again, the camera lingers on it in such a way where it's literally just picture, you know, 3 pounds of ground beef slathered in ketchup, and it's not just enough to film that. We have to just repeatedly show the guy's hands just digging through it. He's not attempting anything. He's just literally rummaging his hands through it.
There's a shot where he tries to pop out an eyeball and fails. So we cut to a different angle, and he succeeds. And I think that might have been the one where they said, let's try that again. I'd really like that eyeball to pop out.
But that's what I wanted to talk about, actually, because the gore is terrible. The effects are terrible. And yet, at a certain point, that shot in particular, the shot of the eyeball is so bad, you're clearly looking at a fake eyeball inside of a mannequin head. No attempt is made to disguise that. And yet, when he jams his finger in there and pulls the eyeball out, the audience reacted because it still bothers you, even though it's the fakest, worst thing you've ever seen. So maybe there is something to the impact that his movies have. I don't know.
Eye trauma is very hard for a lot of people.
Oh, yeah. There was a lot of it.
And then we went from the ridiculous to the sublime, because at 8:45, we screened the original Halloween. And I've seen it countless times. In fact, for a long time, they kept playing with it on home video so that some versions were bad.
Because they had put stuff back in from the TV edit?
There were so many special editions on DVD that there was one where the TV version, there was so many things they had to cut for TV.
Which is crazy, by the way.
That they hired John Carpenter to film some extra scenes that basically repeat information from other scenes. So we had one version where that was on a separate disc, one version where it was cut back. On one of the anniversary DVDs of Halloween, they played with the color timing and the lighting of that film, which I'm such a big fan of. It's all sort of orange and blue. They got rid of it. It was all white. And I read that even Carpenter was like, this really misrepresents the film.
Yeah.
So I had seen it lots and lots of times on home video. But I hadn't seen it in a theater till yesterday, since the Friday it came out, my sophomore year of high school. And after some horror films that are less than successful, man, does it make you appreciate Halloween.
Yeah. The print had seen better days, and I think partially because of where it was placed in the lineup, in that the massacre was sort of at its most crowded at that time, and because so many people had seen it and are fans, that was the movie that sort of got the most audience participation, people yelling out and making jokes and whatever. And it didn't, you know, destroy the movie, but I should probably save this for a future podcast, but I turned to Mike, who was there with us, after Halloween. I have a very weird relationship with Halloween. I think it's great. I respect it. I can stand back at a distance and say that is an incredibly well-made horror film that influenced, you know, legion of horror films afterwards. But it has always sort of left me cold. Like, I never get caught up in Halloween.
And that surprises me because, again, part of it is I saw it for the first time when I was 16, and all of the sort of red herring scares mm-hmm. of someone walking backwards and bumping into something in the corner of the screen, those still work. I still think Loomis's monologue, "I met him when he was 6 years old," is just one of the greatest things. Yesterday at the massacre, when we get to the end of the film, spoiler alert, and Jamie Lee Curtis says, "It was the boogeyman." And Donald Pleasant says, "As a matter of fact, it was. The hair on the back of my neck stood up." That hasn't happened in a long time. But again, maybe this has something to do with the way that you originally introduced to the film or the way you originally saw it, that you're holding it up as an object.
Maybe.
Rather than right. something that right. you're viscerally experiencing.
Maybe. I recognize that the problem is me and not the movie, because when I turned to Mike, I said, "I got something to say about Halloween." He said, "Oh no, are you going to ruin it for me?" Like, that I was going to start shitting on Halloween. I don't have anything bad to say about the movie. It's my own weird thing.
Could it be your obsessive hatred for Babysitter?
It could absolutely be. After Halloween came Poltergeist.
And at this point, JB goes home, because my patented method for getting through these things is to drive home like a crazy person. Get some sleep, take a shower, come back, fresh as a daisy. This year's schedule made that difficult.
Yeah.
Because I really wanted to see Vampire Lovers. But after Halloween, he screened Poltergeist, which again I thought was interesting programming because you sort of have two heavy hitters in a row.
Right. And was very popular with the audience. Doug and I did a podcast on Poltergeist last year, so I won't spend a ton of time on it except to say I love the first 45 minutes of that movie. It's just all the stuff of them in the suburbs as a family, very kind of realistic and believable, the way they all interact with each other. It's all great. As soon as the sort of paranormal investigators show up,
yeah.
the movie loses a lot of steam for me. I think it's overlong. There's a whole section in the middle where I can pretty much check out. A lot of it is Zelda Rubinstein's monologue about what's happening and who the ghosts are, and none of that works for me. But there are still some scenes in the second half of the movie that are great and super effective. And when Poltergeist, like, I give, you know, again, there's debate. Toby Hooper directed, Steven Spielberg directed it, whatever. I'm going to say Toby Hooper because his name is on the movie. When he goes for it in that movie, he really goes for it. That is a hard-edged movie. And when it ended, I had never seen it in a theater. I could not believe that, like, growing up as a kid, my generation got to watch that movie.
Yeah.
That is a PG movie that is so intense at times. I cannot believe kids can watch that movie.
The stuff of nightmares. And speaking of nightmare.
Yay!
If you'd like to see the original clown, it is proudly displayed in the window of the Hard Rock Cafe in Vegas,
yeah.
which is located in the big mall next to Caesar's Palace.
And that Poltergeist plays a very interesting game. It reminds me of Aliens, where you think you're over the last hill on the roller coaster.
Yeah.
And then I realize, oh, wait, we still have the clown to go. We still have the skeletons in the pool. Like, there's a big hump still coming up, perhaps the biggest.
And by humps, he means his lady lump.
Of course.
After Poltergeist was Pumpkinhead.
Yes.
Which, of course, I have seen only this time in my dreams, because I was home experiencing nappy time. Great monster.
It is a good monster, and I was kind of dreading Pumpkinhead because it's not a movie I have any affection for. It came out maybe in 89. I think I saw it on video that year and have never seen it since. I remembered nothing about the movie except the basic setup. Pumpkinhead ended up being much better than I remembered it being, that while still not a great movie, I'm not going to come away saying Pumpkinhead was really good, but I do think it has some ideas about... This, of course, filled the Pet Sematary slot from last year about dead children and the way that we deal with grief.
Which is another reason I'm glad I missed it.
Right, and how we need sort of something to point our anger at. And the movie is kind of about that, at least for the first half. And I also thought it was interesting that a couple months ago we saw Tucker and Dale versus Evil, which takes the sort of southern hillbilly stereotype in horror films and tells it from their perspective in a funny way. Pumpkinhead actually, to an extent, does that too. It takes these sort of very rural characters and allows them to have like a world in which they interact and there are traditions among them, but it's never laughing at them or condescending to them. And the outside, you know, city kids are kind of the a-holes. So it kind of did it in a more serious way. So, and it does have a good monster, though I will never understand. I found myself distracted for the last half of the movie, which is mostly just the monster stalking teenagers. Whenever he shows up, there's constantly like a strobe light coming from behind him. Yeah. And it's not lightning in the sky. So I kept wondering, where is that light? What is the source of that light? The pumpkin head light. Where is that coming from?
The police chasing him? I've always thought that was a decision that the filmmakers made.
Yeah, because it looks cool.
Yeah, too. Right. The danger is always that the makeup, the creature, the rubber will get shown for too long in too exacting detail, and sort of that sort of the crazy 80s equivalent of smoke or fog or something.
And Pumpkinhead is, I believe, the sole directorial effort of effects man Stan Winston. I don't think he directed another movie after that. He died a couple years ago, but his name got big applause.
And yeah, he did direct it, and he also designed the creature himself, which is interesting. I remember the first time I saw it was a long time ago on VHS.
Yeah.
And that back then, my reaction was, it's serviceable. Mm-hmm. It is a serviceable.
And that's basically what I think, because my expectations were low, I was finding things to like in it that I had forgotten.
And now it's 2:30 in the morning, and most of the audience is asleep. Go to sleep, go to sleep, go to sleep, little horror fans. Which means it's time for Fulci.
Every year. And again, I don't hold it against Rusty. Maybe he's a Fulci fan. He knows there are Fulci fans in the audience. He wants to represent sort of this Italian zombie horror. I categorize Fulci in the same place where I was talking about Herschel Gordon Lewis, where I don't understand the appeal, and there are people who like that stuff more than anything else in the horror genre. They love, you know, Lucio Fulci. His movies are terrible and don't tell a story, don't have any characters. Again, you're just waiting for horrible graphic violence. The movies are nonsensical, and it's not in that Dario Argento, it's like a dream. It's not that. It's just bad. And again, this movie, if you were in it for the violence, and there's certainly stuff that's totally repellent. At one point, a girl looks at the ghost of a priest, and most of her insides sort of come out of her mouth. But for the most part, it's people getting the back of their hair grabbed by another character who then pulls on it so hard that the back of their skull and some of their brain comes out. It's basically that over and over again in Gates of Hell, which was the movie that he showed.
Pretty much the story of incredible upper arm strength.
It is nonsensical, and it has an ending that has to be seen to be believed, because the entire audience just thought, what was that? I won't even go into explaining it right now, but it has a ridiculous ending.
And you could actually tell the audience had a reaction?
I really think so, yeah. And again, I know that there were people that were excited to see it. It got big cheers when it came on. A lot of, you know, Fulci-inspired t-shirts around the massacre. Always the black t-shirt with the horror movie poster on it.
Then maybe I misjudged. Maybe Vampire Lovers was sleepy time, because when I got back, it was about a half hour into Vampire Lovers.
Yeah.
And I guess I'm having a hard time coming up with a clever metaphorical way of saying lady lumps. I guess at this point, Hammer Lovelies, as the schedule says, wasn't enough to keep people awake.
Because well, that movie has a much sort of quieter tone and a much different pace than Gates of Hell.
It was a sea of sleeping, snoring people when I got back. Yeah. And always good to see Ingrid Pitt, although my reaction this morning, like every time I see that film, is that Ingrid Pitt certainly has this presence, and they really didn't know how to exploit it other than having her walk around in a dress or get naked or...
Well, they have all of the characters fall in love with her, so that tells us that she's special.
True, but I think she's a better actress than all of those movies give her credit for.
Yeah.
But again, we're talking about Hammer on the slide.
Right.
Where first we go to nudity,
right,
and then we go to the seven golden vampires in Kung Fu.
Right.
In fact, there's some orgy scene in one Hammer film that's incredibly graphic and all full of nudity and people doing things to each other. And at a horror convention, someone asked Peter Cushing, how on earth? And he said, well, no, I wasn't there the day they filmed that. they filmed his bit and then cut him in to make him look. And
I haven't seen that one.
And that's my other reaction to Vampire Lovers. It makes me wonder why Cushing took such a secondary part.
Yeah.
It seems he should be the main. He shows up
at the beginning and the end, kind of. You know, maybe
that he should be the other guy who was originally staking the vampires.
Right.
Or did they feel that would be too much like Van Helsing? It's a really tiny part.
Yeah.
In fact, for most of the part, he's walking around in fog looking for something unspecific.
He's the general or the whatever. It's worth seeing, just not only for Ingrid Pitt, but because the other actress, Madeline
Smith,
wears one expression the entire movie, and it's just sort of a wide-eyed naivete or wonderment. It's very, very funny, even when Ingrid Pitt starts putting, like, the lesbian moves on her. Same expression.
Which is odd, because there's a character in Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things that goes through the entire film with this wide-eyed, not naivete, it's more of a dementia or simplicity or something.
The print, by the way, for Vampire Lovers was beautiful, and then we get into Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things, which had that sort of pinkish,
very pink,
beat up.
And the problem is with these prints for about 20 years, Kodak manufactured film that was defective. When I was going to college, in a lot of the film classes, U of I was running prints that unfortunately had gone pink. I remember the first time I ever saw The Birds. It was very pink. And the problem with pink for a horror film is that a lot of scenes in horror films take place at night. Mm-hmm. And between the night and the pink, you cannot make out what's going on the screen. But of course, I think the print was the least of our problems.
Correct.
With Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things, which, by the way, is not a Bob Clark movie.
No. As it was printed somewhere and got me excited to see Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things. I believe the director is Benjamin Clark, I think, the credited director on
I'm guessing a relative of Alan Ornsby, who both wrote the film and starred in it.
It's roughly an hour. I described it as going to see just the dialogue scenes in Hair as performed by community theater, where it's just a lot of sort of annoying hippie talk and theatrical nonsense.
And they all secretly hate each other.
Right.
And one of them has a big vocabulary and he's a prick.
And then all of a sudden it turns into Night of the Living Dead. And you're
exactly.
Well, finally, here's what I came for. But the zombies are kind of bad.
Well, they're directed to just sort of stand around. Right. They have two modes. Stand around when we're looking at them from inside of a house.
Right.
And then charge forward
if
it's important that they charge forward.
The makeup is sort of uneven, although I thought the makeup on sort of the main zombie, Orville, was that his name?
The one they bring home to mock and
Mary. It's
quite odd.
You question your existence in the first hour of that movie. I thought his makeup owed something to the really creepy guy in Carnival of Souls.
Very much.
Yeah.
Very much. And in fact, those scenes of them bringing a dead body home and playing with it wind up...
That's what they shouldn't do. They shouldn't play with dead things.
Those actually engender so much sympathy for this dead guy.
Right.
So that, spoiler alert, at the end when he comes to life, you're like, yeah!
The whole audience cheered.
You have been treated poorly.
But again, we have to engineer the movie to the moment where the biggest asshole is locked in a room with the zombie that he dug up and married. Oh gosh, that movie was, again, happy to have seen it.
And personally, and I know Patrick hates when we bring politics into the podcast, I don't think anyone should get married until zombies are able to get married in this country. It's the 21st century, people. Children, they deserve...
Children shouldn't marry dead things.
Love is love.
After Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things, two more movies to go, correct?
And again, if you haven't ever sat through 24 hours of horror films, it's at this point that this sort of marathon sensibility sets in. And the minute the Sentinel starts, everyone perks up because it's like, two to go.
But also because, I think, the Sentinel, while crazy and not good, but bad, I think, in a way that's entertaining.
you put it best. It seems to be a third. It's three different films right. that were very successful. It's
The Exorcist, The Shining. Although The Shining hadn't come out yet, so I can't really say that. The Exorcist and Rosemary's Baby.
Very much. And maybe a little bit of The Omen.
I thought The Shining, just because the apartment is sort of haunted in the same way that...
Or something like Burnt Offerings, is. Where...
Right.
The studio was obviously trying to cash in. And boy, this was one of the two films that I had never seen before. And the credits start rolling. And the cast in this movie is incredible. And it just keeps going. And the audience is cheering. And oh, and Eli Wallach is in it. And Martin Balsam in it. And introducing Christopher Walken. Oh my God.
I don't even think Jeff Goldblum got a screen credit. But he was on screen very early. So you knew who he was in it.
And Jeff Goldblum. And later Tom Berenger. I mean, it's just boom, 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 boom. Beverly D'Angelo
masturbating furiously.
That was disturbing. That might have been the scariest thing in the film. And I never thought I would hear myself say that.
It's a crazy movie. And it was, and you know it's crazy because it was made by Michael Winner, who made the Death Wish movies.
Which is the first thing I thought when his credit appeared on the screen.
You thought of Death Wish 3 with Martin Balsam?
Oh, there's a connection.
That's the craziest of the Death Wish movies.
Oh, trust me, the scene...
It's a crazy movie, and it's hilarious because it goes to places that you... aren't anticipating it will go, but then it doesn't know how to get out of those places, so Chris Sarandon is left to deliver some exposition in a way that's almost totally thrown away.
For a second, I thought you were talking about Death Wish 3.
Is that what did I say?
Chris Sarandon.
I got it. Yes.
The scene I like in Death Wish 3 is when Charles Bronson teaches senior citizens to set up these very elaborate coyote roadrunner traps.
It's a for crazy the punks. Movie.
And it's a board that with springs up and hits you in the face and it gets people's teeth
and they go like, yes. It's like, yeah, we got him. Let's have dinner.
But back to the Sentinel, it's about this beautiful woman who moves into this apartment, and clearly something is wrong because Burgess Meredith lives there. Or does he?
I actually was surprised. There's a twist fairly early. I thought that was going to be the twist, that she's living in this apartment building with all these people, and you find out sort of very early on that that might not be the case. But I thought, as soon as that concept got introduced, I thought, oh, well, there's the reveal, you know, an hour and a half from now. So they reveal it very early on and then go in another very strange direction. But that movie's available to watch on Netflix Instant, and I almost recommend doing it because I think it's crazy in an entertaining way.
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'm caught in my own loopiness. And I think this may have been the first time that the massacre ends a little bit early. Oh, and that shows that it supposedly started at 9:20. My guess is it started more like 9:30. And he shows from dusk till dawn, which is sort of poetically appropriate. And once again, just like when Halloween screened, after sitting through some things that may not be the greatest horror films ever made, suddenly we're watching something. I think it's very entertaining.
It is very entertaining. That movie came out in like 96, and I was sort of, Tarantino had just come on the scene, and I was in high school maybe, and I was, you know, starting to get more into film, and Tarantino was the guy you looked up to. He was like the guy that young people sort of embraced as like, he's cool and whatever. So I was very into him when that movie came out, and I really liked the movie. I haven't seen it in probably 10 years, and while I enjoyed it, and it's very entertaining, it never felt messier to me than it did today. I mean, that it's so sloppy. And part of that is Robert Rodriguez, but part of it is that the movie has no concern for anything else that's going on, except for like the 90 seconds that you're dealing with at the moment.
Very much.
So what's going to happen in the future or what has happened before doesn't matter as long as we're within the 90 seconds. I mean, the big example, I guess, would be some characters get bitten by vampires and they turn into vampires an hour later. And Fred Williamson gets bitten by a vampire, spoiler alert, and is a vampire within 11 seconds.
And I don't know, the only criticism of the film that I ever thought was sort of valid is that the last section of it does really go on and on and on.
Right.
But as a fan of that type of thing, my reaction to that was, well, there's more to like. It was never more evident to me that because Tarantino wrote it and Rodriguez directed it, that what we have here is the first half of it is a Quentin Tarantino film, mm-hmm. and the second half of it is a Robert Rodriguez film, very, right. very specifically. I mean, you could see the actual point at which it turns.
Right. George Clooney, who I like in the movie, and, you know, he does a good job being a badass, but he's given way too many, like, cool guy lines, yeah. just too much dialogue in general. Actually, today, more than ever, really thought Harvey Keitel does such a good job in that movie. And he's always good. He's Harvey Keitel. But in the scenes early on where he's sort of being intimidated by George Clooney, he's really good and infuses those scenes with much more than I think the movie warrants, perhaps.
He's the anchor of the film. I so love that he's in this because, you know, he was instrumental in getting Reservoir Dogs made. And so he keeps popping up in these films. But his performance is great. It's certainly not as flashy as the other performances.
Right.
And he is the anchor of the film. And the one thing I sort of carry with me that until I saw it again just a few hours ago, ladies and gentlemen, yeah. that I kind of forgot that I took from this film is late in the movie, he turns to Clooney and basically says, "Don't you understand? You've won. Can't you enjoy the fact it could have went down this way? It could have, right. This could have happened. You've won." And I find myself in my life and also talking to other people that very often that's a very human trait. You've won. Enjoy that.
Right, right.
And that's something that resonated with me personally.
And then the massacre was over. And that was a good note to go out on because it was it's fun and entertaining. And, you know, again, if it's a marathon, that's sort of the little sprint at the end that's easy to get through.
And it was interesting because this year, as opposed to at least four other years, in previous years, drunken young men have sat behind us who are not funny, who have no sense of humor, and think our desire to not hear them during the films is the stuff of easy mockery. And this year, sort of accidentally, I managed to corral some former students who came to sit behind us, and that was delightful because, A, we didn't have any of that nonsense, and, B, I got to hear their reactions mm-hmm. occasionally mm-hmm. to stuff that I take for granted. None of them had ever seen From Dusk Till Dawn before, and they were amazed by how violent it was because it's an incredibly violent picture.
It's that over-the-top kind of cartoony violence, and it's a vampire movie, but it's much more of a zombie movie because it's so gag driven.
They were amazed at how far it went, and something that I've forgotten because I've seen the film a couple times, the big reveal at the end when the camera pulls back,
yeah.
they were really taken by that. Yeah. They really thought that was cool.
It would be neat to see that movie and not know what it's even about, you know, to not even know that it's going to turn into a vampire movie halfway through. Obviously, I never really had that luxury because I knew what it was, but that would be so crazy jarring.
I sometimes wish, but then I think it's a lot like something wild,
right.
where halfway through it takes this turn, and audiences when it first came out, because that was advertised as a madcap romantic
right.
comedy,
right.
were not prepared for where that film was going to go.
My favorite comment, by the way, from your from the row of students was that at some point during The Vampire Lovers, one of the young men began sort of chiding one of the other young men for falling asleep. "I can't believe, of all the movies, you're missing the one with the naked lesbian vampires."
Yeah.
He was very upset that they were missing girl-on-girl action.
They were also sort of surprised by the amount of nudity in that film. And again, I think
there was that much in that movie.
There wasn't, compared to other films made at that time.
Sure.
We've talked about this on the podcast before. Things are way different now than they were in the past. But why should we be surprised by this?
Right. And that wraps up our show on the Music Box Massacre.
If you have the ability to play this one, I should have said this at the beginning.
Okay.
Just a little bit faster, just adjust the pitch. I think both of us were
We've been up for a long time, but we do it for all of you guys. So keep doing the scary movie challenge, and thanks to everybody at the Music Box and Rusty Nails for doing another great job.
We love you, Rusty.
We look forward to next year's show, and thank you guys for listening.
And Patrick and I are going to go have a slap fight.